This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcasts might know Rick Britton. He's an award-winning historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On Wednesday, April 20th, 2011, NPS historian Ed Sanders delivered a fantastic talk on one of the war's most vicious battles. Fought between May 31st and June 12th, 1864, the Battle of Cold Harbor was the last combat of U.S. Grant's aggressive overland campaign. At Cold Harbor, Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia dug in along a line stretching 6 miles and inflicted 6,000 casualties while suffering very few themselves. It was a bloodletting that future President U.S. Grant lived to regret. This is the first in a six-part series for 2011. Here's Ed Sanders.
Well, the first thing I would like to do is thank all of you for inviting me here this evening to give me a chance to do something I truly love to do, and that's speak on the American Civil War, in particular, the battles and campaigns fought around Richmond. Now, the topic that I've been asked to speak on tonight is the 1864 Battle of Cold Harbor. And I think out of all the battles fought around Richmond, the one that has the greatest name recognition is Cold Harbor. I believe Bruce Catton said Cold Harbor is one of the hard and terrible names of the Civil War, perhaps the most terrible one of all. And the reason I think Cold Harbor is so well known is because of what happened on June the 3rd, 1864. On that day, the Federal Army of the Potomac would attack a well-entrenched Confederate Army of Northern Virginia. In that assault, the Federal Army would suffer heavy losses, much of which in a short period of time, for no gain whatsoever. An assault that would one day would eventually become one of General Ulysses S. Grant's greatest regrets. Unfortunately, because of that June 3rd assault, many people feel that Cold Harbor is just a one-day battle, and that is not the case. It is 2 weeks of fighting at Cold Harbor, punctuated by large assaults by the Federal Army on June the 1st as well as June the 3rd. And what we will do tonight is take a look at that two-week-long action. We'll try to get a better understanding of why Grant would order that assault on June the 3rd and how he could sustain those type of casualties. And we'll also try and put Cold Harbor into the proper context for the campaign as a whole. Now, in order to do this, I would like to start not at Cold Harbor, but jump back to the beginning of the spring campaign of 1864. And keep in mind, 1864 is an absolutely critical year of the war because it's an election year. And the Confederates realize if they can achieve enough victories, or if they can hold out long enough, perhaps they can win a victory, not on the battlefield, but at the ballot box, if someone else other than Abraham Lincoln is elected president. Lincoln realizes this as well. So he looks to the North's most successful general, a man by the name of Ulysses S. Grant. And he brings him from the Western Theater to the East and gives him command not of the Army of the Potomac, but instead all the Union armies. So no longer are they working independently of each other. Now there's one controlling hand, and it belongs to Grant. Grant would decide to establish his headquarters not in Washington, D.C. He was not that type of a general. He wouldn't head back to the Western Theater either. Instead, he decides to establish his headquarters in the East with the Army of the Potomac. Now, keep in mind, the commander of the Army of the Potomac is still General Meade, and this puts Meade in a very awkward situation because he is now a commander who serves directly under another commander, and it is one that will cause friction between the two men. Grant and Meade will begin their campaign against General Robert E. Lee and the Army of Northern Virginia at the Wilderness, beginning of May of 1864. The two sides will fight it out, suffering heavy losses. Lee will check Grant, but unlike other Union commanders following the setback, Grant does not retreat. Instead, he maneuvers and he continues south. Once again, the two sides will clash at Spotsylvania Courthouse. They are fighting for some time. They are once again suffering tremendous losses. But when all is said and done, Grant once again will disengage and continue south. Keep in mind that throughout this campaign, Grant's primary goal is not the capture of Richmond. Yes, he wants to take that city eventually, but it's not his primary goal. And he doesn't want to get to Richmond without fighting Lee either. He wants to fight Lee in the field because he realizes that Lee's army in Virginia is the Confederacy. And so he's hammering away at Lee, at the Wilderness, at Spotsylvania. Eventually, the two sides will confront each other along the North Anna River, but there, Lee's defensive position is so strong that Grant will realize that even success would not be worth the casualties he would sustain. But as he leaves the North Anna River, as Grant begins to disengage from Lee, he begins to see that his campaign is working, and he sends a message to General Halleck. Grant to Halleck from the North Anna on May 26th. Lee's army is really whipped. The prisoners we now take show it, and the action of his army show it unmistakably. A battle with them outside of entrenchments cannot be had. Our men feel they have gained the morale over the enemy and attack him with confidence. I may be mistaken, but I feel our success over Lee's army is already assured. That's just about 1 week prior to Cold Harbor, and I think that's important to keep in mind, that this is how Grant views the Confederate Army. Right or wrong, this is how he views it. And you can make a case that this is not the same Army of Northern Virginia of 1862 and 63. The losses that have been sustained, not just in the ranks in the men, but in the officers as well, and the leadership. Just in the campaign alone, Longstreet wounded at the Wilderness. Jeb Stuart, mortally wounded at Yellow Tavern. Even at the corps level. And this continues down to brigade and regimental. You see Lee doing more and more throughout this campaign because those officers, those people that could see an opportunity and then seize that opportunity, many of them are gone now. The two sides disengage from the North Anna River. Grant will cross the Pamunkey River, a place known as Hanover Town and Nelson's Ferry. Two sides will try and figure out where their opponents are, so they send out their cavalry. You have the Battle of Hawes Shop take place between these two cavalry forces. And while Hawes Shop will be a federal victory on May 28th of 1864, much of the advantage was gained by the Confederates, because the Confederates were able to determine that federal infantry had crossed the Pamunkey River. Lee had the information he needed. And so he will make a new defensive position along Totopotomy Creek. The next day, May 29th, the federal infantry will begin to push forward towards Lee's position on Totopotomy Creek, the two sides now confronting each other once again. And the federal army will put part of its command on the south side of Totopotomy Creek. The 5th and part of the 9th Corps will be on the south side with the rest of it on the north, and Lee sees an opportunity to strike. Lee still is thinking offensively. Lee will write this to General Anderson, May 30th, 1864, while the armies are on Totopotomy Creek. After fortifying this line, they will probably make another move by their left flank over towards the Chickahominy. This is just a repetition of their former movements. It can only be arrested by striking at once at that part of their force which has crossed the Totopotomy. Lee puts this plan into action. He has General Early, who has replaced General Ewell in command of the 2nd Corps, launch an attack at a place known as Bethesda Church. But the attack goes very poorly for the Confederates. The Federals are easily able to repulse it. And Grant sees this. He sees the Confederates stumbling offensively. Now things begin to shift towards an intersection, a crossroads, about 9.5 miles northeast of Richmond, known as Old Cold Harbor. General Phil Sheridan would write of the importance of Cold Harbor. Our occupation of Cold Harbor was of the utmost importance to secure our communications with the White House. Roads from Bethesda Church, Old Church, and the White House centered at Cold Harbor. And from there, many roads diverged also towards different crossings of the Chickahominy, which were indispensable to us. This is also where the very unique name comes from. I think when I have worked at the Cold Harbor Visitor Center, I've had more people come in and ask, well, where exactly is the water? But it wasn't that type of a harbor. It seems the term came from England, and that harbors, or cold harbors, were places where travelers could stop, get rest, get meals, get a cold meal, cold drink. So cold harbors were common along the stage routes. Sitting at the intersection was a tavern known as Burnett's Tavern. That was the old Cold Harbor. And because that tavern sat there, the crossroads became known as the old Cold Harbor Crossroads. And since that's where the fighting initially begins, you get the Battle of Cold Harbor. Well, on May 31st, Phil Sheridan and his Union horsemen will approach Cold Harbor from the east. When they get there, they find Fitz Lee's cavalry already there, defending it. A cavalry fight will ensue between these two forces. Three regiments of Thomas Clingman's infantry brigade will come up to assist the Confederate cavalry. But even with their support, the federal troopers will take the intersection. The Confederates will be forced to fall back. But as Sheridan holds that intersection, and the hours pass, what he sees in front of him alarms him quite a bit. He sees more and more Confederate troops pouring into the area. He sees more and more Confederate infantry pouring into the area. And he realizes he's quickly becoming outnumbered, and he also realizes that that infantry is much stronger than his cavalry, can usually brush cavalry aside. He sends dispatches back to headquarters. He hears no words. Finally, he decides he's going to take his command and leave. So in the middle of the night, he begins to head away from Cold Harbor. Of course, as he does this, he does receive word from headquarters. And what do the orders say? Hold on to the crossroads at all hazards. We will send reinforcements. He takes his command. He turns them around. He was very fortunate to discover that the Confederates had not found out that he had left. He has his men dismount. He has them make crude defensive works to the north, to the south, to the west, any direction the Confederates may come at them, and they wait. By the morning of June the 1st, the Confederates have maneuvered two divisions of Confederate infantry into the area. Probably about 12,000 men of Hoke's and Kershaw's divisions, and they will launch an attack to retake that vital intersection. The unit that I like to follow for this attack is one regiment, the 20th South Carolina Infantry. And I like to follow it because it is brand new to Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. It has spent the entire war up to this time in the defenses of the Carolinas. So their uniforms are in excellent condition. The men are well fed. The regiment is so large it numbers 1,200 men. Other Confederates jokingly refer to it as the 20th Army Corps because of its size. Its commander is a man by the name of Lawrence Kitt, who the famous diarist Mary Chestnut said of Kitt, he is the quintessence of efflorescence. Lawrence Kitt, being a political man, came up with his command, visited President Davis, mentioned that he would like to be assigned to Kershaw's old brigade, which was a brigade of South Carolina troops, so that made sense. And when he joined Lee's army, he was put in Kershaw's brigade, but Kershaw had already moved up to division command, and now the brigade was commanded by Colonel Hannegan. So I'm sure Colonel Kitt and Colonel Hannegan exchanged pleasantries at some point. And then when you have two colonels, someone's going to ask, what's your date of rank? Because that's how you find out who's senior. And now Kitt has found out that he is the senior colonel and now commands this veteran brigade. So here you have this inexperienced officer leading this veteran brigade, and which brigade was going to play a critical part on the assault on the morning of June 1? Kershaw's brigade, now led by Lawrence Kitt. Kitt will put his very own unit right out front. He doesn't put out skirmishers, which he normally did, to feel out the enemy. He goes into the action on horseback, which by this point in the war, most officers are not. As they push forward towards the Federal cavalry, one of the first volleys, Kit is mortally wounded. Now his inexperienced men begin to break. They begin to run. The morning attack was beaten back really before it ever began. Confederates will try once again later in the morning, but it too is easily beaten back. Now keep in mind here, the Federal cavalry have some advantages. They're fighting defensively behind some crude works that they've made, but also many of the soldiers had been issued the Spencer repeating carbine, or they have breech loading carbines, a very quick rate of fire. And on the defensive, those weapons can be devastating. And you compile that with uncoordinated Confederate attacks, Federal cavalry holds off Confederate infantry. They hold off long enough for the 6th Corps to arrive later in the day, followed by the 18th Corps. Now, the 18th Corps had just joined the Army of the Potomac from the Army of the James. It had been down around Bermuda 100, but was not having much success down there. Grant needed the manpower, so he pulled it up to join the Army of the Potomac. They got on board boats, sailed down the James, up the Pamunkey, got out White House, had some trouble finding their way to the Army, but eventually got there. And now here they are at Cold Harbor. The Confederates would basically fall back, make their own defensive line, and now wait for the attack to come to them. On the afternoon of June 1, if you take a look at the maps I gave you, there's one that says June 1. This is for the first major attack launched by the Federal Army. 30,000 infantry of the 6th and 18th Corps are now here. About 20,000 are going to push forward in an assault that will stretch for over a mile. They will engage Kershaw's and Hoke's division, probably about 12,000 men, maybe elements of Pickett's and Field's division, maybe another 10,000. But primarily they will hit Kershaw and Hoke. The unit that I like to follow for this afternoon assault is once again just one regiment. The particular regiment was a member of Upton's Brigade. It was the 2nd Connecticut Heavy Artillery. Now, this is a heavy artillery regiment that was recruited and meant to man the defenses of fortifications like in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, man the big guns. But they were also foot troops. They were also taught to handle small arms. And there were these healthy, strong regiments sitting in the defenses of Washington and Baltimore. And Grant needed the manpower to offset the losses from Wilderness and Spotsylvania. So they are now being pulled down, and the 2nd Connecticut is about to go into its first major battle. Its colonel is a man by the name of Elijah Kellogg. Kellogg will get in front of 1st Battalion of 500 men. He actually breaks the regiment. It's so large, it numbers 1,500 men. He breaks it into 3 battalions of 500 men apiece. He gets in front of the 1st Battalion. He talks to the officers. He tells them what he wants them to do. He draws a diagram of the Confederate position as best he understands it. And then he gets in front and gives the command, forward, guide center, march. And now they begin to push forward. Past open fields, open woods. They come up on some Confederate pickets who quickly fall back. And these Connecticut soldiers in their first major battle think, this is nothing. We're going to be in Richmond before dark. They're falling back in front of us. Then they come up towards the main Confederate line. Rifles come up over the works, and a tremendous fire pours forth. But for the most part, it goes over their heads. A soldier from the 121st New York would write this. A little in front of the works, there was a hollow, and as a column went into this, it seemed to pause, and the rear lines closed up. Probably because of that little hollow is why that fire, for the most part, went over their heads. The rebel fire was very effective, and it seemed to us where we stood that our poor fellows would all get shot. The ground over which they had passed was covered with men. We could see them fall in all shapes. Some would fall forward as if they had caught their feet and tripped and fell. Others would throw up their arms and fall backwards. Others would stagger about a few paces before they dropped. To us, the suspense was horrible. We could not understand the pause before reaching the works, and we said to one another, "What are they stopping for? Why don't they go on?" But the agony was soon over. K. Kellogg was reforming his men to make the final push through the Abati towards the Confederate positions. Just as he was about to push forward, Kellogg is killed. And in one of the most remarkable accounts from the Confederate commander, Clingman, Thomas Clingman, he seems to describe what I think may be, can't be sure, but what may be Kellogg's death. This is what Clingman wrote. In a loud voice, I said, "Aim low and aim well." And as I did this, a tall and uncommonly fine-looking officer in the front rank of the enemy's column, hearing the order and looking me directly in the face, though he changed countenance for a moment, took off his cap and, waving it above his head, cheered his men in words I could not catch. Just as he placed his hat back on his head, and before he had time to lower his hand to his side, a soldier immediately on my right discharged his musket, and the ball entered the upper part of his forehead, and he fell backward, staggering the two men behind him. Now the 2nd Connecticut began to panic, just like the 20th South Carolina did earlier in the day. But at that critical moment, the brigade commander, a man by the name of Emory Upton, came up on the scene. And Upton was one of those type of officers who could stamp out fear like you could stamp out a fire. He told the men to fall down right where they were. He saw some of the Confederates running into the distance. And he said, "See the Johnnies, boys, see the Johnnies. We'll have them yet." There are accounts of him standing behind a tree and having the men hand him rifles, and he single-handedly firing towards the Confederate position and throwing them back to be reloaded. When one nervous young officer of the 2nd Connecticut came up to Upton and said, "Sir, the men are running low on ammunition, and if the Confederates attack, I don't know if we can repulse them." Upton said he was going to have no word of falling back. He said, "If they come, stick them with your bayonets and pitch them over your heads." Wow. He was going to hold the ground. While the 2nd Connecticut was held there, other elements of the Union Army were able to advance. What had happened is the 2nd Connecticut, according to the regimental history, had marched out in front of the rest of the Union line. Its left was nobody's right, its right was nobody's left, and it was receiving this full, devastating fire. But as he held them there, other elements advanced. And when they did, they found a gap in the Confederate line, a gap created by a ravine made by Little Creek, known as Bloody Run, a gap that was about 50 to 75 yards wide. Federal soldiers will begin to funnel through that ravine, and all of a sudden, Clingman's men, who are firing away at the 2nd Connecticut in their front, all of a sudden, they receive a devastating fire in their rear. Clingman's brigade will now swing back like a gate would swing open. Here is the break in the Confederate line that Grant has been looking for. The fighting will continue into the darkness, through the night. Eventually, though, the Confederates will plug up the gap. But this partial success had on the evening of June 1 emboldens Grant. He felt more could have been done on that day. He wants to capitalize on what's already been accomplished, so he orders an attack for the very next day, June the 2nd. But he realizes, if this attack is going to be successful, I need more troops in the area. So he's going to order the 2nd Corps under General Winfield Scott Hancock to march from the far northern end of the Union line to the far southern end of the Union line. And on this particular night, it's going to be very hot. The roads are going to be dusty. The 2nd Corps is going to get somewhat lost, basically assuring that the attack will not be able to go off on the morning of June the 2nd. The attack is postponed till later in the day. When the 2nd Corps finally does arrive at Cold Harbor, it is exhausted. It has marched all through the night. There's some other logistical problems that need to be taken care of as well, so Grant now postpones the assault once again. Now, till dawn of June the 3rd. And what that has done is it's given Lee time. Time to shift his army accordingly, and time to dig in. And by this point in the campaign, you did not have to tell soldiers to dig in. If they were near the enemy, they knew to start moving earth. But now Lee has the time to have his officers, have his engineers look at the ground to make a strong defensive position. Initially, soldiers would use their bayonets, tin cups, anything they had. But with more time, the wagons come up, the shovels, the picks, those type of tools come out. This is what one of the Union generals, by a man by the name of John Gibbon, who commanded in the Second Corps, would write. A few hours were all that was necessary to render any position so strong by breastworks that the opposite party was unable to carry it, and it became a recognized fact amongst the men themselves that when the enemy had occupied a position 6 or 8 hours ahead of us, it was useless to attempt to take it. If I remember correctly, I think Theodore Lyman had in his book, Theodore Lyman was a staff officer with General Meade, and I think he had a great quote as well. To paraphrase it, he basically said, if you give Lee's army a day, he could have a suitable field work. If you give him 2 days, he could have a field work with artillery support. Should you give him 3 days, he could have a field work, artillery support, and obstructions in his front. And then Lyman went on to say, a lot of times they can do 3 days' work in the first 24 hours. So here the Confederates have had the time they need to make a strong defensive position, a defensive position that will stretch for between 6 and 7 miles. Think of that. 6 to 7 miles of men, pretty well stretching from up to Totopotomy Creek all the way down to the Chickahominy River. Lee's army probably numbers about 56 to 60,000 men at this time. A northern reporter would write this of the CS earthworks. Intricate zigzag lines within lines, lines protecting flanks of lines, lines built to enfilade an opposing line, lines within which lie a battery, a maze and labyrinth of works within works. It's what they built. So then why does Grant attack? John Gibbon said, if you give the Confederates a few hours, you have a little chance of success. Lyman said pretty much the same thing. Why would Grant attack? Some would say, well, it's just, you know, that's just Grant's nature. He would make those type of assaults, and I don't buy into that. It may have actually been the right decision. How it was carried out is a completely different thing. But look at it as Grant might have on the evening of June the 2nd. These lines are stretched along a 6 mile front, 6 to 7 mile front, with his back to the Chickahominy River. And Richmond beyond that. If Grant does break through, Lee's going to have to try and retreat across the Chickahominy to reach the safety of the Confederate capital. Grant's army has just been reinforced by the 18th Corps from the Army of the James. It's now stronger than it has been in some time. Grant said he had faced similar situations before where an enemy had been well entrenched and he had still had success. The war was costing the federal government millions of dollars every day. And the reason Grant was brought from the Western Theater to the East was to make this type of decision. You can look at General McClellan in 1862 and give him the same scenario and say, attack. And he wouldn't. And you go, well, why won't you attack? And then finally, think of it this way. Or remember this, I should say. Remember that dispatch that he sent to Halleck? Lee's army is really whipped. The prisoners we now take show it. The action of his army shows it unmistakably. So I look at Grant as a risk taker. He felt he had things to his advantage and he was willing to take that risk. So I can understand his decision to make the attack. However, how it's carried out is a completely different thing. Basically, orders will go out for the Corps commanders to look in their front to find the weakest point and attack on the morning of June the 3rd. And to a degree, that makes sense. Attack the weakest point in your front. But also what it means is no one's working together. Everyone is doing their own thing. General Smith, who commanded the 18th Corps, was somewhat confused by this order. He communicated with General Wright, who commanded the 6th Corps. He said, hey, our two corps next to each other, what are you going to do tomorrow? And General Wright was one who said, I'm going to pitch in and march straight towards the Confederate works. And Smith found this hard to believe. Dawn of June the 3rd comes. Union artillery will open up to soften the Confederate position, and what should have been an army-wide assault very quickly breaks down into piecemeal assaults, primarily with the 2nd, 6th, and 18th Corps initially attacking. And even those attacks are piecemeal. Of all the attacks, the only one to have success was on the far southern end of the line. If you take a look at June 3rd map, you'll see Hancock's, you'll see Barlow, Brooks' Brigade. In that brigade was a regiment, the 7th New York Heavy Artillery. Once again, another one of these heavy artillery regiments fighting as infantry. They will temporarily break into the Confederate works. They will attack a weak point, capture some prisoners, have some success before Maryland and Floridian troops that are to the rear will be able to push them out. The only success it's had on June the 3rd is over with in a fairly short period of time. The rest of the Second Corps takes very heavy losses. The 18th Corps, if you jump up beyond the 6th Corps, that would be the 2nd Corps, then the 6th Corps. Let's jump to the 18th Corps for a moment. That's the one that's just joined the Army of the Potomac from the Army of the James. It's going to attack one of the most difficult parts of the Confederate line. It's going to attack along a ravine, not the same ravine as Bloody Run, not the same ravine where they had the breakthrough on June 1, but another ravine to the north of it. And the Confederates will basically make a U in their line. And the 18th Corps will basically be going in a column of division. So imagine this mass of men now pushing forward along this ravine, going towards the Confederates, and entering the open end of that U. So now they're being hit not by just the front, but also by flanking fire as well. This is the area where you really have the killing fields of Cold Harbor. This is where you read the accounts of soldiers being hit by more than one bullet at a time as they go down. The 18th Corps will suffer tremendous losses on June 3rd making their attacks. The 6th Corps, in between the 18th and the 2nd Corps, they're kind of crushed on a fairly narrow front, and they've been as close to the as close to the Confederates as any Federal soldiers. And as the day wore, as the morning wore on and got closer to the attack, they quickly realized they had little chance of success. So General Russell will talk to General Wright, and finally they will determine that they are not going to make a serious push. Yes, some elements of the 6th Corps will attack. Yes, some will be engaged, but they are not going to make the same type of attack as the 2nd or the 18th Corps. So much so that a Confederate general in front of them by the name of Johnson Haygood would write that he was awake and vigilant the entire time and never realized a major attack had been given. And that's because in his front, there wasn't one. The 6th Corps realized the strength of those defenses and never made a serious push. Farther to the north, you have the 5th Corps under General Warren, and it was stretched along a very long front and would not make a serious push. And then up on the far northern end, you have General Burnside, who would make attack, but it would be later in the morning. And it too would be beaten back. Finally, the attacks would be called off. What was it like for the Confederates? Behind the safety of their works, the casualties were fairly few, probably about 1,200, maybe 1,500. What was it like for the Federals? In an hour's time, the Federal Army would suffer probably about 3,500 to 4,000 casualties. Throughout the course of the day, 6,000 casualties. Grant will later write that was one of his great regrets because of that loss for no gain whatsoever. You often read that Grant will lose 7,000 men in 15 to 30 minutes at Cold Harbor. And I guarantee we can go to many books and we can find that quote. But when you add up the casualties, when you read the accounts, when you look at what happened, it appears that it was not all in 15 minutes because some units didn't even attack till later in the morning. So there's no way it could all happen in 15 minutes. Casualties appear to be more along the number of 3,500 in the first hour, 6,000 throughout the day, which is still horrible. It is still one of the worst tactical defeats of the war for the Federals, and still one of Grant's great regrets, but it's not quite that 7,000 in 15 to 30 minutes that you often read about. But that does not end the Battle of Cold Harbor. The Union Army does not retreat following this. They fall down, they dig in. And in the days afterwards, they become just as well entrenched as the Confederates. And now you have a completely different type of war. A sharpshooter's war. War of misery. soldiers waking up in the morning, forgetting where they are, standing up for a second, and they're gone by the sharpshooter's bullet. Also, the smell on the battlefield was horrible by this time. One Confederate soldier said, "I don't know what Grant's up to, but I think he's trying to stink us out." Private Ezekiel Graham wrote, "I've been upon some 20 battlefields, but the enemy's loss was greater on this field than I've ever saw before. Our regiment had 6 killed while 157 of the enemy lay in front of our regiment." That is true on some areas of the battlefield. One thing to keep in mind is do not stretch that for the entire battlefield. What happened? You have certain areas where you have tremendous carnage. In other areas, like the 6th Corps, particularly with more veteran units, that realize it doesn't look promising and do not make a strong push. So some units will get cut to pieces, particularly newer ones, ones that have just joined the Union Army, ones whose officers don't realize at what point it no longer looks promising, want to prove themselves. Those are the regiments that get cut up. And then veteran units stop very quickly and realize certain areas, tremendous loss, other areas, not as much. A truce is not declared to take care of the wounded, bury the dead, until June the 7th. Yes, there are accounts of Union soldiers going out at night under cover of darkness to look for their friends, but many simply couldn't be reached. Finally, on June the 7th, the truce is declared. Look for the wounded, bury the dead. But by that time, very few wounded left on the battlefield. Most had died of their wounds. Union soldiers go about burying the dead. Confederates come out, start watching them. And according to Theodore Lyman's account, he says that some of the Confederates started to talk to their counterparts, begin to chit-chat while they're working. And the big topic, of course, is, "So," Confederate soldier asks his counterpart, "who are you going to vote for in the upcoming election?" Union soldier stops digging for a moment, and he finally says, "You know, I think I'm going to vote for Old Abe." And this Confederate soldier, who couldn't believe anyone voted for Old Abe in 1860, couldn't believe anyone was going to vote for him again in 1864. And a fist fight breaks out during the truce after the battle. Once the armies taking care of the wounded, buried the dead, they return back to their trench lines. Some of them are very close. One Second Corps soldier for the Federal Army said it's a mere biscuit's throw to the Confederate works. And Grant has another major dilemma. Where do I go now? What do I do next? Grant decides that what he wants to do is head down to Petersburg. He doesn't want to lay siege to Richmond. The army had been there in 1862 and melted away, not from the Confederates, but from disease. Chickahominy River, or the Chickahominy Swamp, is not the healthiest place to keep an army for a long period of time. And if you look at a map, you'll see down at Petersburg, most of the rail lines from the Deep South head up to Petersburg, then up to Richmond. So Grant realized, if I can cut Petersburg off from Richmond, I can cut a big chunk of the Confederacy off from it. But how does he get there? His army's stuck at Cold Harbor, a mere biscuit's throw to the Confederate works. Here, I think, is one of Grant's greater moments as a general after one of his worst defeats. He'll begin to disengage. I should say, first, he will send his cavalry off on a raid towards the Shenandoah Valley. This will force the Confederates to send part of their cavalry force off to intercept them. What you have take place is the Battle of Trevilian Station between these two forces. But more importantly, you have the eyes of the Confederate Army, at least the majority of them, gone. Grant begins to consolidate his lines. Then he begins to disengage, night of the 12th into the morning of the 13th. He crosses the Chickahominy, he crosses the James, and crossing those rivers was a great threat because he was afraid that the Confederates may discover what was happening and could attack one part of the army while the other half could only watch. But he was able to cross the Chickahominy, he was able to cross the James, and he was able to attack Petersburg. But when his men made the attack at Petersburg, they saw more trenches, earthworks, fortifications, except these works were much more impressive. than what they saw at Cold Harbor. These works were part of the Dimmick Line, semi-permanent works built to protect the city of Petersburg. The only thing is those works were not that well manned. But I think those Union soldiers remembered what happened at Cold Harbor. After a month's worth of fighting from Wilderness, Spotsylvania, North Anna, and then the disastrous attack at Cold Harbor, understandably, they were hesitant. And while they did take sections of the Petersburg line, they didn't take all of it, and that gave the Confederates the time they needed to shift their army down to Petersburg, starting that 9.5-month-long siege. After that siege, they had finally the evacuation of Richmond and Petersburg and the march to Appomattox. So as we look at Cold Harbor, we see the Cold Harbor was the last major battle of the 1864 Overland Campaign. It was fought on the very outskirts of the Confederate capital. Initially, it looked very promising for the Federal Army, but by the time it was over with, it would prove to be one of the worst tactical defeats that they would know throughout the course of the war. And Grant would later write one of his greatest regrets. And it truly illustrates the type of warfare that you see being fought in 1864, trench warfare. For those that are able to make the trip, you will see some of the best field works that you will find on any battlefield. And I would like to thank you all for giving me this opportunity to talk to you a little bit about the 1864 Battle of Cold Harbor. Thank you so much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.